The national level threats to cryptography, because they have the most amount of PhDs and most amount of resources, so they naturally are going to be one step ahead of everyone.
And we don't know that that exists. This is the challenge, right? So, you know, the reason we suspect that's valid is because of historical data, right? If you're a Bayesian, you know, if you ask this question, you go, okay, prior instances where this has happened, it has shown to us that, you know, national level security actors have significant advantages over average Joe blog on the street. So this is like a, you know, this is a thesis that we can validate multiple times over, right? I gave the example of, you know, DES, you know, DES being, you know, proposed as by IBM as Lucifer. And, you know, they had some feedback from NIST, which I was describing as S boxes. And when differential crypto analysis was actually, you know, I would say proposed by Shamir, which is the S of RSA, it so happens that the set of boxes, which, you know, NIST has said this is good, it's very resistant to differential crypto analysis. So that clearly shows to us that there exists a world which is not visible to you and me, but, you know, definitely slightly advanced. I don't know how many years, right? So it is very possible the same thing applies in, you know, not in terms of just possibly math, possibly hardware, possibly very large clusters, you know, ASIC, custom ASICs, right? And the real question we have is that of quantum computing, right? Effectively, these there exist, a quantum computer that can actually do the factoring at the size of things that, where things start to matter, right? We don't know. Like you and I would be finding it very hard to understand. So this is a question that we have to live with. So, you know, you and I are in a place where.
Yeah, and regarding quantum computing, what tools can we utilize in the cryptography toolbox that would make something quantum computer resistant?
Okay, so let me give the background and then we will switch. So typically, you know, you have two classes of cryptography. We kind of discussed this before. We have symmetric, where the keys are, same key is all used to lock and unlock. Asymmetric, you have one key to lock and another key to unlock, right? Now, everybody's name, it's like imagine you have a hotel and everybody's room number is there and keys are there. You have your own keys, right? If you want to open it, you know, you could actually put something into your room by using the key that's in the public. But if you want to open it, you need to have your key to open it. So that's kind of how you can think about it, right? So in the public key scenario, there's typically two classes of public key cryptography. One is what we call integer factorization. Given a random, very, very large number, you know, how hard is it to actually, you know, factorize it? So like break it into is smaller prime numbers, right? So that's one problem. And that's considered like NP complete, and it's been proven it's NP complete. NP complete means like as the size of the numbers increases, the effort required is not linear, it's polynomial, right? Non-polynomial in that sense. So it's like, you know, sure kind of thing, right? So the other one is a discrete log problem. Discrete log problem is like, given a generator of a group, you know, G to the power equals X, the generator G is known, X is known, find A, right? So how many times you have to multiply G to get X, right? And there's a variant of this, instead of multiplying in elliptic curves, it's point addition, right? This is called ECDLP. So these two problems, this is the discrete, you know, integer factorization, IF, and discrete log problem, this is like DLP. And there's this, you know, weird assumption that everybody has consensus on, like ECDLP, the elliptic curve discrete log problem, is like harder than DLP, right? So for a given size, you know, that's why our, you know, size of, you know, curves and point sizes and things like that is like much smaller than RSA, right? RSA, you'd be normally having like 1,000, 2,000 bits kind of thing. And if you look at the elliptic curve thing, we are typically talking about like around 200 bits plus or minus, right? So I get it gives you the intuition. So now what's the problem? The problem is like once we have quantum computers that could support something like Shor's algorithm, right? Shor's algorithm is the algorithm that was proposed by Peter Shor. I think he was in Bell Labs or AT&T. I think AT&T, right? What this allows is like you can do, so the definition of the two problems I defined, which are the hard problems that forms the basis of, circuit computing, is in the class called BCP, right? B for Bat, C for Charlie, and P for Papa, right? And in one sense of speaking, if you were to think about it, it's like finding cycles in abelian fields. So it's linear. What that means is like, if your key size increases, it's like if it's three times the key, three is a bad number. Imagine a five. If you want to do for a 5-bit factorization, it takes two, then it's 10. So if you increase it to 10, it's 20. But if it's exponential, like 5 to 10 would be going from 25 to 100. You know what I mean? It's like that, right? So this is a problem. Like once you have computers available, the class of problems that we currently have will become very difficult, meaning like they'll be, easily solved. But there are a class of other problems that already existed. So, public key cryptography had some other cryptographic primitives, which are based on coding theory. Example, Michaelis, right? So it's these are problems that are there. And then there are like other knapsack problems, which have the right kind of knapsack problem is like imagine you have a bag. Without looking at the bag, if you know the weight of each of the contents, you'll be able to say what it is. And it was proven to be NP complete, but there were some attacks that came up. So there was a class of knapsack problems which have a Chore reverse density of some optimal thing. And there was like learning with errors and all those things. The class of primitives that you can have, which you can actually use, that is not based on these two, we could continue to use. And I also need to add one more thing because it's like, given we talked about quantum computers and there's another algorithm that we normally talk about if we were to talk about quantum computers and what they can do for cryptography. So remember, we have the other class that has the same key that opens and locks. So in there is this algorithm called Grover's algorithm. So there's an Indian scientist called Niels Grover. He came up with an algorithm. The speed up that you have is square root n. So you could think of this as like, if you were to search in an unsorted database, you'll have a square root n speed up. So n raised to 1/2. So these are the two things that you have. If you do symmetric key cryptography, that's the problem you have when you have quantum computers. It's much less. But if you do public key cryptography, especially if you're doing integer factorization or elliptic curve discrete log problem, we have a significant problem. So that explains.
So, how does information theoretic security fit in that?
Okay, so information theoretic security means the following, right? So if you were to go back in time and if you were to talk about Claude Shannon and this communication construct, so how much of a surprise you have in every next bit that comes through? So you would have to have like something like a QKD, the quantum key distribution mechanism, to achieve the equivalence of information theoretic security. Okay, so let me just give you like an intuition of how this normally works. So the thing that could give like information theoretic security, if I am not mistaken, top of my head, is like if you use one time pad, right? One time pad is the size of the keys is equivalent to the size of the message. You take one bit of the message, XOR with one bit of the key material, and you send it across. Because of this, randomness of the key material, it completely hides, right? So your probability of guessing is as good as guessing in a random bit. And you need to have securely transmitted or shared between the two parties the initialization vectors of this material that you need to actually XOR, right? So if I were to send something, let's imagine like a theoretical exercise. You and I have a book, right? Let's randomly pick a book. Okay, let's try one. Okay, let's try this one. Right, this is a book about like a Bridgewater, like analyzing vice, blah blah blah. So you and I know this is a book, right? Now what we could decide is like we agree to certain pages in this book, right? And while we agree to this, even though it's not random, okay, we still have shared secret material that we can actually use to, do encryption and decryption. So that's the, and they call it the code book in one-time bad sense. And you can only use it once. So, after you're done with this book, who knows? You probably might have to do something, do something else. Maybe, next set of book would be like after Steve, right? And we agree this is the next one. And we can continue doing this. The only thing is you and I need to ship the same set of books on Amazon to our wherever respective places and do this. So you can achieve the thing. And in a slightly different way, if you were to do this, you using quantum key distribution. So I will describe a scheme, the simplest of the scheme. So the simplest of the scheme is BB84, Bennett-Brazard 84. And the story is, okay, I met both of them and I've heard the story from somebody else. I've never, when I talked to both of them, they never said the story. So the story is like they went to San Diego. I think that's where the crypto conference happens. So there's like a beach. And so Bennett and Brazard were in the beach, and Bennett actually swam towards Brazard and said, proposed this scheme. The scheme is very simple. So you have photons and you have polarizers, right? You have two polarizers. So, imagine you're putting a ball through that oscillates like this, and you have a filter that's vertical and a filter that's vertical, right? It'll go through. If you have a filter like this and a filter like this, the odds that it'll go through is very low, right? So once you know the polarization, and if you send the photons across, you can send one bit and you almost get like information theoretic security. And the better part of this is like if anybody tries to intercept, the party will know. The party on the other side would know, oh, somebody's actually trying to intercept. And this is typically what everybody sees as the benefit of having a quantum key distribution.
Right, so that could be a way to future-proof some things with from quantum computers, because if you can know if it's being
I
tampered
mean,
with and
it
it's.
really doesn't, in one sense of speaking. Okay, the problem is the following, right? There's two classes of problems. Key distribution is like transferring key between two parties. But remember our conversation, we can have two classes of cryptographic tools. One is like same key, lock and unlock with the same key. And we have, a set of public keys and an unlock with a private key. So you have your private key, I have my private key, both the public keys are listed in the front of the hotel. You know what I'm saying? So the problem here is not that how we communicate, but how do we lock things inside, right? So if you lock things inside, we need to use the not integer factorization, not elliptic curve discrete log problem, right? But you can use other things like coding theory based ones like Michaelis. We have the constructs like fry, right? Essentially, things that where hash functions or pseudo randomness provides hardness. So unless the days when we have a time travel machine, we are okay. We are doing okay.
Okay, so what you're saying is that these other methods would be sufficiently quantum
Yeah,
resistant. They are
resistant.
hard
Yes.
enough.
Sorry, apologies. So,
That's okay, I can just edit it.
okay. So the thing I was about to say is like NIST actually has a mailing list, and they have a bunch of things that have come out. And I used to be on that mailing list for quantum resistant, schemes. There have been a good number of schemes, and initially things like NTRU and other ones. Like the thing is, a lot of matrix operations, crazy, crazy things, right? Anything that's So imagine you have a universal set of all things, and you have like two easy, well-documented things that are there, just the integer factorization and discrete log, and the subset of discrete log is elliptic curve discrete log. And for us, you and I, who is involved in doing crypto, elliptic curve discrete log is the bigger problem. And of importance to us, right? And the thing here is, like, you know, we probably will have to replace this, you know, at some point in time, right? We don't know when.
Mm-hmm.
But I should also caveat this in such a way that it's seen in the right context. I don't think this is going to happen immediately for crypto in that sense. So imagine everything. So let's imagine our phones, right? Let's imagine our debit cards and credit cards, right?
Yeah, I think the traditional banking system is way more fragile than crypto.
Absolutely. All the traditional infrastructure is going to be F-starred first. Because look at the set of all assets in the world. That's trillions and trillions. And look at crypto. Tiny. Tiny. Right? Why should we be the guys who should be shitting bricks? Right? You don't have to. Let them shit bricks. When that happens, we can do this. And it's easier for us in that sense of speaking. Look, when everybody actually agrees there's a big problem, it's easy to change it because, like, you know, agrees that we have a problem. Shall we do this? And you go, yeah, and then we go.
So the solution to this, like the substitution for the elliptic curve that we have right now, would be applicable to blockchains without much of implementation concern.
Yeah, it's more the politics of the situation rather than technical stuff. This is my cynical view, right? So I don't know how I would describe it, but generally speaking, it's much more easier to do things when there's agreements and agreed hierarchies in place. So the challenge we have in a decentralized world is like consensus building, not in the consensus. Consensus building for protocol building is a harder thing. So it's like the cost of achieving consensus among humans is very, very high. So if it's a nation state, say US will have NIST, right? So in the ZK proof in end of November, so Rene Peralta was there and he looks after a whole bunch of these things and he was giving a talk. And like, it's quite clear that they have thought a lot of things and they have clarity on what they want to do, right? Whereas in a decentralized world, you can't say something. I can't say something. We definitely don't know who Satoshi is as far as I know. He can't say anything. Other people can say, and so we'll see.
Well, it might come to the death and rebirth of a lot of projects that don't adapt fast enough.
I
think that's a good few decades away, I imagine. I don't know how fast quantum computer research is going or how far away it is, but...
Yeah, this is the very interesting thing I wanted to point out to you. So there are like a whole class of problems. Okay, I should start with the obvious and then describe the rest. So the obvious is like human beings, between you and I, we could give a very good bound on short-term problems. So this, I put my hand up. I've been reasonably good at recognizing technology trends for the last 15 plus years. Okay, so I worked on the cloud 2007, worked on big data 2010, 2011, 2012, like my first strata talk in 2012. Worked on open source robotics, what you call drones, 2009, 2010 till 2016. Crypto for a very long time, like ski.crypt times, late 90s. Crypto, like, I would say like 2010, 11, right? It's in like the way we know it, right? So for me, I've been quite consistent in understanding trends and saying things. But if you were to ask me, I'm being incredibly honest here, right? In 2013, Anish, would you do X? Like, would you be able to predict which two protocols would be top five? I would have no effing clue. And having said that, for whatever it's worth, I worked on two of the top five, right? Again, what I'm saying is like sometimes, you recognize things in the short to medium term easily. Long-term impacts is like very hard to fathom, right? You one never knows. So, you know,
Yeah,
making guesses, yeah.
the potential, the different possibilities branch out too far away. I mean, it's very hard
Absolutely. The
to,
J-curve kind of thing, right? Like, you know, if it's a linear thing, it's easy for us to recognize, but the exponential curve is the thing that when it starts taking off. It's like, so in 2007, if you were to see an iPhone and you were to think about it and you were to ask, it's like, okay, you know, what are the odds that Apple will actually have an augmented reality thing? You would say, and even like, you know, most people look at Nokia, right? Nokia looked at, and this is not the first time somebody has tried to create a phone like this. But the first time, multiple people have tried. Same is true about iPad, right? Okay, we had learned experience of this in 2000, starting 2002, right? They all failed terribly. So there you go. So you and I.
Yeah. And speaking of trends, what trends do you see nowadays that would be worth following for aspiring developers or entrepreneurs, either in the crypto space or outside of the crypto space, or
Okay, so I'll say a
any?
couple of things. Yeah, I'll say a couple of things. So, number one, this is my observation, and this is my the way I keep track of things. So, you make a list of topics that you think are going to have significant influence, right? So, and then look at the commonalities. Okay, so what I mean by that is like if you want to do machine learning. So this is deep learning, generative AI, LLMs, all the crap, right? And that all boils down to a class of problems in linear algebra and later math, right? So if you know that, you can do a lot of things. You look at like if you are interested in public key cryptography and so number theory, abstract algebra, that kind of stuff, right? So it gives you like a whole tool set. So in my mind, without a shadow of a doubt, in the short to medium term, ZKs, zero knowledge protocols, FHEs, that's fully homomorphic encryption, and like a bunch of other cryptographic primitives will have, you know, new improvements in MPCs, will have a very interesting, you know, impact on whatever happens. And if you look across the board, across to the ML space, similarly, the large language models and reinforcement learning derivatives of that will have a significant impact in the short to medium term, right? In the long term, I believe, you know, other intersectional bits. So intersectional bits is like if you were to draw a bunch of Venn diagrams. So robotics, right? Robotics has lots of pieces in addition to machine learning attached to it. You know, things like synthetic biology, right? Even though synthetic biology has lots of interactions with machine learning in one sense of speaking, weird sense of speaking, it's a self-standing thing, right? And like if you put those things together, you will see places where things interact or intersect. You might find things which makes you unique. What I mean by that is like the number of people who understand two or three things good enough to actually, you know, do something will increase your odds of being special. In the age of ChatGPT, generalization is a very, very tricky, risky thing to do. Generalization, in a sense, like understanding constructs is useful. Generalization, if you know, if you're going to be a Python programmer writing generalized Python code, most of the Python code that you have could be written by you know, ChatGPT and other LLMs already, right? So you can only imagine like 3 to 5 years' time how that might look like. So you definitely need to understand. So it's like similarly, as I was saying, like there are adjacent things like understanding hardware, right? So, you know, when you were to look at, let me just give you an example so it gives you. So if you understand hardware, if you understand, say, you know, something along the lines of, you know, some machine learning stuff and some cryptographic stuff. If you intersect all three, the odds that you will have, you know, of doing anything successfully increases a lot because, like, now you are among a very few people who understand the math, who could actually implement it in hardware, understand machine learning, understand cryptography. That's what you call convergence, right? And if you could do robotics to that mix, then you'd be like one person in, kind of thing.
In speaking of the mix between hardware and other disciplines, do you see any applications of ZK in addition to hardware?
In hardware, in addition to hardware.
I mean, combined with hardware.
Yeah, I mean, like, the thing here is like, if you were to have anything that you do today, if you can have hardware, you can improve the speeds, right? So let me give you an example. So I need to give you some examples so you understand the construct. Imagine you walk back in time by 25 years. I'm sorry, that gives away my, age. So I used to work in micropayment systems in 2000, right? I was hired from India to go to Stockholm to work on a micropayment system for Ericsson, XP Telecom. So one of the problems we had at that point in time was that, remember I talked about integer factorization and RSA? RSA was hard to do on a server. So if enough of clients connected to the server, it'll overwhelm the server. And what was happening here is that we had hardware. This is called, SSL accelerators, right? Rainbow, Thales, N-Cypher. And I would pretty much go as far as to say that the innovation that actually allowed on the experience of online shopping is SSL accelerators. So let me explain why I say that. So, if you actually wanted to send something, even if you had a credit card, you wanted to have SSL, right? Fair? You're unlikely to send your credit card details, PCI implies they won't allow
Can
you
you
to do
briefly
that.
describe SSL for everyone?
Oh, yeah. So SSL is secure socket layer. So if you were to look at your browser, there's a key lock on top, wherever it is, right? So all this does is like, it uses. It supports both Diffie-Hellman. So remember, I talked about discrete log. That's Diffie-Hellman, normal version Diffie-Hellman, and RSA, as in the RSA that I was talking about in the factorization. So there's a server and the client. They say hello, and they then do a handshake. End of the process between the two. You can, if you have certificates, you can do like, verified mechanism. But otherwise, certificates is like X51N kind of certificates. So you say, root of trust. This is like a hierarchical trust, right? So a certification authority will issue you a certificate and you can actually go click on it. I mean, this is all normal. Like, this is the basis of the life we actually have. If you were to try install something into your Apple thing, it says, no, it's not trusted, right? Similarly, you got a website, it says it does not trust it. What is a trust? That trust is the hierarchy of trust, right? The hierarchy of trust and certification authorities and the set of certificates they actually allow, right? So this is the basis. And so this, allowed to have a session key generated between the two parties. Even if you don't have a trust, you can have an ephemeral key. And then once you have an ephemeral key, you can get a session key and use the session key to actually encrypt things between you two. Of both of us. So if somebody were to try eavesdropping on us, they won't be able to re-read it. So, imagine you want to send some credit card information, you could do that, right? That's kind of what this is.
Right, I see.
So ZK, same story. So when you have the equivalent of SSL accelerators, the change will happen. If you were to go back in time 25 years and you wanted to just do an SSL session, you would have to wait a bit. And you had to flip E and D, the encryption and decryption, components the other way around so that the largest number actually stays in the client side and server does a smaller one. And then the size of E and D would change. So all these things happen, right? Like all of this has happened without anybody noticing. And my argument is like the same thing has to happen to ZK. For ZK to enter mainstream.
And do you see any specific plugins places where this is primed to happen, or e specific
I believe it will happen in a
applications?
very generic sense. So the reason I say this is the following, right? So now you and I, if when we need to authenticate to something, we need to use passwords. Passwords, as you know, every year, there's like a massive attack somewhere happening, and you lose all the passwords. So if it's a ZK mechanism, no passwords, right? You could securely authenticate. And your ZK could be your mechanism to authenticate to your bank, to your government.
Right, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
And similarly, consent, right? And you could have a whole bunch of things that could happen. Like, you could actually have like a, you're talking to your doctor, doctor wants to talk to somebody else. Doctor doesn't have to reveal like all the things, but you can get a proof. And then, all the normal things that it's very hard to do right now, we can do. And look at finance, right? Let me give you a good example, which really resonates with a lot of people in crypto. The story of collateral debt obligations, CDOs, right? So the reason why we possibly have Bitcoin and the reason why we have crypto, right? And collateral debt obligations was, taking, triple C negative, bundling them and calling AAA, right? But this would completely be impossible if you had zero knowledge proofs, right? So all the rating agencies could be blown out of the water in that sense. Rating agencies doesn't necessarily need to exist. You can do this computation. So your credit score mechanism could be a zero knowledge mechanism. Like all those things where there is data behind, you want to do some computation and you want to prove that this is valid, right? All of that could happen, and it'll be like enormous, changes in the way, things operate.
Yeah, awesome. And with all that taken into account, why did you decide to go into ZK in the first place and ended up here now, co-founding Panther?
Oh, it's a very simple thing, right? When I met, I mean, when I ran into ZK, it really blew my mind. And I don't think most people recognize the power of ZK. Okay, let me explain this to you. ZK has this three characteristics, right? The three characteristics is like zero knowledgeness, soundness, completeness, right? And sometimes I confuse soundness and completeness. But in summary, this is the following. Imagine you have a personal interaction with somebody. Could be anything. And between the two parties, you really don't want to reveal what it is. But if you were to run a zero knowledge between the two parties, so this could be you and your girlfriend or you and your partner of any kind, right? You could pretty much, A, prove to the other party that what you say is true. And as long as you tell the truth in computationally bounded time, you'd be assured that the other party will believe in you. Do you understand the power of that? That blew my mind. So that's the story
Yeah.
of ZK. I know, most people
I
don't
for
recognize,
me
but then a moment, it takes a moment before they go, holy shit, right? Wow, I should
yeah for
create a zero
me
knowledge.
yeah well for me when I heard about it, and I when I realized he made it possible to tell someone a secret, I mean tell someone a secret without telling them what it is. It feels kind of like those magic technology moments. Like, how is that possible?
It's not the secret, right? Like all you're saying is like, I can prove to you,
Exactly.
right? You make a claim. You could prove to the other party that your claim is valid without ever revealing what that claim is. Like, so you can say that you have the proof that you could live across time,
It's just like
right?
the.
So.
The crypto equivalents of trust me, bro.
Yes. Wow, that's the best one I've heard so far.
Yeah, that's how I think
So
of it.
yeah, imagine imagine there was an equivalent of a ZK for trust me, bro. Then that'll be all the scammers will be done. All the
Exactly, yeah.
So going back to your question, like how did I end up doing Panda? So what had happened is like I'm always interested in information arbitrage and structures in power. So I have a spare time interest in philosophy. So between me and my co-author, we published a paper called The New Secret. It's available online, you can read it. And it kind of describes how structures in power evolve from potential information arbitrage. Let me give you an example so you understand how in the primitive world, information arbitrage would convert you from an average human to representative of God on Earth. Okay? So this is how this happens. So you have been watching when the moon turns up. Okay? Now we are at a point in time in history where there's language exists, which means, okay? That's language, right? Primitive language, right? And now you recognize that 20, lunar cycles are 28 days. You go up to the highest in a mountain and you go, oh, moon god, don't turn up today, right? Job done. Moon god doesn't appear. You know, the next day, moon is going to come back or next day. It depends on where you are, right? You just need to make sure that your calendar is right sync. You go back up and say, oh God, come back, please. All these guys have agreed to our terms, right? Wow. You see? Now you have the ability to control moon. The fact remains that information arbitrage here is there is zero correlation or zero causation. Correlation exists. And this is a very important construct. Causation is not equal to correlation. The correlation exists that the person looks up and says, oh, moon god, don't turn up today. Oh, moon god, come back tomorrow, right? That has nothing to do with causation. And this is information arbitrage applied to humanity. And this still exists. You can see this in politics. You can see this in religion. So I was like, look. This was before Susanna, the lady came up with this construct of surveillance capitalism. How we explained it. And to me, when I looked at blockchains, I was like, wow, and DeFi was taking off. I'm like, guys, Zcash won't be able to support DeFi primitives. Okay. So if DeFi has to, so it's very simple and everybody normally assumes things to work the normal way, right? The reason why a lot of the things work in traditional finance is because of privacy. Let's ask the obvious stupid question. Can anybody tell me the models that Renaissance technology runs? Why is it private? Why are they allowed to be private? Why is it that all the strategies that you and I deploy in DeFi has to be public? Why? Why, oh, why? I think that's an information arbitrage. And we have the tools to do this. So this was, this is the motivation behind. Okay, we have constructs that the society as a whole has agreed to operate to doing trades. So dark pools are allowed. We have KYC. We have compliance. As long as we can replicate one to one to those things, we should be able to do the same things because those are the pools which have the largest amount of alpha. And also, what we need to recognize is in the open ecosystem, depth of the market disappears in no time because it's like the moment you could literally, put a whole bunch of bots or so, you go on a graph or someplace like that and then deploy a whole bunch of subgraph to monitor a bunch of wallets or smart contracts. And then you could literally write a smart contract to like replicate the trade and you know what I'm saying, right? In very short order, you can take the depth of the market. So this is only possible because there's no privacy. This is the whole, in a very simplistic view, idea that we should have composability, privacy, and compliance, and KYC all rolled into one. So we could actually have the same primitives that we have in the traditional finance world.
Yeah, awesome. I think that all makes a lot of sense. And I think there's a lot of people that caught up on this and are trying to deploy similar projects. So, can you describe what Panther Protocol actually is and then go
Sure.
into how it differs from the their competition, like Penumbra
Okay.
Railgun
Yeah.
and these other
I'll
protocols.
give you, yeah, I'll give you like a, you know, there are lots of similarities and lots of differences. The best thing I would say is like, I always point to things written by other people rather than my opinion. I mean, I believe that third parties who are, you know, no incentives are much more likely to be unbiased and give you an opinion that you can probably trust, right? So, you know, the thing here is like, if you were to think about like Greenfield, they published an article comparing all the different privacy protocols, and probably you can share it in the show notes so people can actually see. We pretty much implement all the things that have that they propose as mechanisms to provide compliance, except like committees, right? Committees are human interaction things, which we really don't want to get into. So let me kind of give you like a high level what Panther does, how we do it, and some intuitions of differences. Firstly, you know, I would describe, you know, going back to a previous conversation, Panther as, you know, dark pool on demand for DeFi. So compliant, dark pool on demand for DeFi that actually
Can you
does
explain what a
support.
dark pool is as well, please?
Oh yeah, sure. Remember, we were just talking about Renaissance Technologies and all those guys, right? So what happens is that is like a market where you can't see, you know, what the orders are. Okay, let me give you kind of an idea. So if you were to go at an exchange and look at it, you can see the sell and buy, right? You can actually ask and sell in that sense. So you can actually see where things are happening, and that gives you like clear indication to what is happening, who is getting what, right? And this, you know, has lots of challenges which I summarized previously. So this, when shielded, becomes a dark pool. There's actually a book called Dark Pool. I forgot the guy's name. Hold on, one sec. I have another book from the guy. So I think the guy's name is Dan Robinson. And let me see. Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, I'll dig it out and I'll let you know. I'm looking for the book. The
Yeah,
book is
no
somewhere
worries.
in this pile.
I can
Yeah, I
just
think I saw
link
it.
it in
Yeah,
the show
I
notes
think.
later.
Yeah, I think. Hold on one sec. Yes, it's Scott Patterson. That's the guy who actually wrote the book. This is another of his books. So that's why I know, you know, if you look at the bottom, he says dark pools. So.
A little sidetrack here. You seem to have a lot
Yeah.
of books behind you. Do you prefer physical books a lot more than, for example, a Kindle?
I do have both. You know, I used to live in London. In my house in London, I had a you know, good few thousand books. Now I kind of live in Dubai, and I don't have that many books. But the thing with books is like, I have a visual memory, so I recognize things like ooh. Whereas in an iPad, like I read a lot of things on iPad, but iPad, my visual memory is not that vivid. I'm sure you understand what I mean, right? Remember,
Yeah,
I
yeah,
just
yeah.
realized I saw this, right? I
Yeah,
knew
yeah.
dark pools. Yeah, okay. So
I
this is the
see.
thing.
Yeah,
So, you know,
that makes sense.
So this is like, and I have, so effectively, you were asking me a question. I can tie the whole thing together. So, you know, as part of the whole process of keeping myself updated, so my new year, every year, my new year resolution is like make a list of topics that I need to improve upon, and then I remove a few, add a few, make a reading list, and then I systematically go through them. So, you know, I have not done any significant amount of work on machine learning and deep learning. So this, I decided I'll do that. So I got, you know, a couple of books. So textbooks normally, right? So this is one of them. This is another one of them. Like, you know, so every year I do this, and I do an audit every quarter, and sometimes I take off topics, add new topics. So in all of that is only possible, you know, easily. Okay, the thing is like human brain can actually, you know, keep a lot of things. I have a lot of books, electronic books, right? I mean, like I pay I don't know if you know, Aurelie used to have like a subscription model, and I was one of the guys who, really early on started it, right? Like, I have so many subscriptions for all those things. And over time, what I realized is like, I don't really read all of them because it doesn't remind me. Whereas this is like, when I see this, I go, oh, this is the other way around. Okay. So, you know what? That bit there. And sometimes it's like cross-referencing in my head. This thing looks at galaxies. I do astrophotography, right? You could probably see things in the back, right? So I connect things. So in my head, I will be doing filters. I will be thinking telescopes. I'll be thinking, Go-To-Mans, and a lot of things in my head. The convergence happens in my head, and it helps. So, because I have very little attention span, and I jump across so many things.
Yeah, no,
Pictures.
there's definitely something to the physicality of information that we consume, and when you
Multiple
consume
senses,
content
that's what it
that,
is, right? So,
yeah.
in addition to just reading, you can smell, you can touch, right? And there's even a sound, right? That's in addition to just visual, you got three extra. So your state space is bigger. If you think of it mathematically, instead of having a linear space, you have like a, in a four-dimensional space. So the distance between the thing is clearer.
Yeah, and it also translates into the way you consume the content because it's the weight of the book and is the arch the pages make when they flip, and it's all this
Yeah,
context that
absolutely.
just
Yeah,
puts you
absolutely.
more into the moment and like translates into your brain.
It's the way our memory works, right? Our memory, it's like an association of things. So, you could possibly remember some food you had in some place you had. You could remember what the s smell and taste, right? So your memory, it is not just numbers and digits. You have a lot of other things. So
Well,
use all of that to,
yes, so our memory is basically spatial mostly because that's what we evolved to do, hunt animals, run, jump. So anything that you can do to make use of your space to help you learn and soak in a subject is probably going to be effective. So that's why reading books for the vast majority of people are superior to just reading on a screen. It's just more in your physical space that you can interact with.
That to me is like, yeah, go ahead.
I was just gonna say, let's go back to the main topic, back to Panther.
So, I kind of describe Panther and I kind of describe what Panther does and the differences. Like, so let me explain the key differences. And I'll explain how Panther works and then I'll explain the key differences. So you can do a lot of the privacy things in different places, right? You can build a layer one, right? And do this. So that's Zcash, that's Monero. You can do a layer two to do this. There are a few instances of those things, right? If Starkware were to provide privacy, that'll be a layer two, right? I don't know where Starkware is because apparently they have just deleted all their Telegram groups and things of that sort. I don't know what's happening with them. Yeah,
Oh.
you could probably look at Alex, CEO of Helios post about Twitter post about Starkware, and you can figure out what's happening there. I don't know. There could be things happening. I am not. I don't have a crystal ball again. Then you can do it in the smart contract layer, right? So in the smart contract layer, the thing here is a good thing and a bad thing. Good thing is the fact that it's very easy to interoperate. You can deploy it in any of the EVM compatible ones, right? You find an EVM compatible one, you're not bounded, you can do it. At the same time, you're kind of at a layer where it's harder to actually do any hardware exploration, right? So firstly, Panther actually does privacy in smart contract layer. The other bit is as follows. So when you are going to use Panther, what happens is you would be asked to go talk to one of the compliance KYC, KYT providers. Know your customer, know your transaction, which is the same thing that you have in banks. And we have one called Purify. So you go to Purify, they will do all the thing, and then they give you something back that you could actually use. So you could go into like a zone. So Panda has zones. The zone actually allows you. So effectively, this is like a one-to-one map to real world, right? So if you have KYC, your KYC is valid for a region so that the geographical arbitrage, couldn't be invoked on you in that sense, right? So, different geographies have different, arbitrages. So, we replicate that. So once you are there, your KYC provider would allow you to be in that particular, what I would call a zone with KYC requirements, so you can interact with them. So the reason why this is important is, like, if you are in the US, if you interact with, say, just assume and take an example, real solid example, a FAQ can actually ban like a bunch of addresses. If you accidentally interact with any of them, you are in big problem. So you want to make sure that when you do KYC, you are in a pool that none of the OFAC people are there. I mean, OFAC banned people are there. Right? That exposes everybody to risk. So this is kind of what we do. So effectively, we have a multi-asset sheeted pool, which allows you to actually do this kind of thing where you can deploy your strategy onto, say, a DeFi protocol like Uniswap. And then once you are done, you probably want to describe to IRS a set of transactions that's called disclosure. So we have some mechanisms by which you can do disclosure. And also on the backside of it, when you do KYC, your transcripts is actually available to IRS if they want to go to the KYC provider. We don't keep any of these things in the two parties. That probably can help you. It's A, the customer or the user. B, the KYC provider. This is like a standard thing in like normal banking. So you could think of, normal banking and how that would map to a possibly DeFi world. That's what we have created, and that's what we have deployed, and that's where we are.
Some might say that it's a little bit paradoxical to have QAC on a privacy-focused protocol. So, what is the takeaway from that?
So, we have to live in a world where reality exists, right? You could, so you could probably do say something like this. I am a nudist, okay? So I would like to walk around. So it's very valid to do so in a nudist beach, right? But if you were to walk around naked in Saudi, you might end up very soon in certain places, right? So there are regulations how you can do things, right? So, we, whatever we might say in Web3, we are exposed via the bridges to the Web2 world. The Web2 world is very regulated. So, there is very little we can do to get past that. So that's my summary.
It's the integration needs to happen at some point, and I think this is one of the ways that we can make it happen. But switching a little bit into the core functionality of Panther, is it kind of like an order book exchange, or is it like a MMM? Can you interact with other
Okay,
applications on
let me
Ethereum?
simplify the whole thing for you. So the construct of order books is a lot more complicated, right? And the reason we actually have AMMs is it's easy to do this in the UTXO model. So we are using the UTXO model. So what we do is we have, say, Uniswap on that side. We create an adapter. So when on the AMM side, what you see is Panda smart contract, which actually has the mask, acts like one entity. And inside it, there could be people actually doing strategies which cancel each other out. So X Dubai is a constant. The same thing applies. V3, off you go. So this could be Aave, this could be Uniswap, you could be Curve. Yeah. So I hope that makes sense to you. So you can actually create a strategy which has multiple protocols. So you could have, one end of this product, your strategy touching through the adapter to Uniswap, another end of the, strategy touching Curve, another end of the strategy. And inside Panther, it is, moving all around. External world, it'll be like different pieces. But, you have your strategy in one box, and all these things are like private internally. and it works like that. So I guess that makes sense to you. So the construct of you know, keeping an order book doesn't exist. We just do the privacy bit. We use a UTXO model to actually manage it. Slightly complicated. The simplest way to think about it is you have a magical box. It does things. It works for you. We provide you with the proof. No, trust me, bro. We use ZK.
Yeah, so how does it look like from the... So you have all these things going on in Panther. We can't really see. It's a black box.
Yeah.
People are trading on these different protocols. So how does Panther communicate with the protocols itself? How does the communication happen, and how it prevents any leakage of information coming from within Panther?
So the question about leakage of information is as follows, right? It's a very important and very simple construct I should have explained slightly earlier. So, you know, the classic case of how do normal zero knowledge protocols work? This apartment has one door. You can only come in and go through one door. You and I could come up to the door and I could say to you, hello, you know what? I have the ability to escape from this room without using the door. You say, go ahead, prove to me. So I'm the prover, you're the verifier. You and I come to the door, you let me in, you lock the door and stand there. 5 minutes later, you see me outside. That is zero knowledge, right? Zero knowledge, the fact that I can escape. Now, so imagine that I provide proof that I'm inside the room, right? If there's just one person in this room, you're pretty fucking sure that is me, right? There are two people in the room, you know, you have half a probability guessing. If you have 1,000 people in the room, you have 1 in 1,000 chances. This is the thing, right? So the challenge is like having enough of privacy set, so your anonymity set, so the odds that somebody could guess is much lesser.
Right, so it's a power in numbers in this case.
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
Oh, yeah, right. Can you briefly as well describe what did you mean by UTXO and why that matters?
Oh, okay. All right, okay. So simple.
Just
so
a
let's
short,
go back
short,
in time. You go back in time and do the normal thing. So when we go back in time, the real innovation in Bitcoin was the creation of UTXO, right? UTXO is like, oh, okay, I think I need to explain a bit more. So bearer instruments. Bearer instruments is the basis of most of economy, in one sense of speaking, like at least the UNI thing, right? So I am in this part of the world. I have money. This is like UAE money, right? So it's like 1,000 UAE, whatever it is. So what does this mean? If I present this, the government gives the guarantee that it's worth 1,000 dirham. It's a bearer instrument, right? Nothing else. So, you know, important thing, if I take this out, I give it to you, my wallet doesn't have 1,000 AED, right? Now, you know, if it's electronic, I send you one, I can keep a copy, and now I can double spend, right? So instead of having 1,000 AED, I have 2,000 AED. I can have N into 1,000 AEDs, right? And this is double spend. And what did Bitcoin allow you to do? Prevent double spend. So how is this done? It uses a mechanism called UTXO. It proves that this has been spent before. That's it, as simple as that.
I think that's a good way to summarize it without going too long on it. And if you're interested in to actually knowing what it means in practical terms, go and look it up on Google. So, one thing that I don't know much about, and I think you probably researched this when deciding whether to implement KYC or how to implement KYC, is the proof of innocence to prove that your transactions are legitimate without revealing the transaction details. Is there something you know about that you'd be able to share a little bit?
So, okay. So let me say something so that everybody is kind of clear and what it means and what does it mean. So if you were to think of this as an exclusion proof, it's almost impossible to have an exclusion proof in ZK. I hope that makes sense. So it's like, I am not a member of this thing. The proving that is harder. It's easier to prove I'm a member of something, right? So the proof of innocence essentially is the proof that you've actually done awful things. So the way I would describe it is like, remember most of our conversations are about universal sets and subsets, right? Subsets are smaller, easier to represent. Universal sets are harder and they have more members. So this is what this means. If you could actually come up with mechanisms by which one could say, I tick all these boxes, that's the kind of proof of innocence. So this could be that you could prove that you've met KYC, KYD. You had no interactions with anybody of any kind, and you could actually provide provenance of whatever the crop is, right? So this could be one way to think about it. This is like, me describing things without going into details.
Yeah, no, it makes sense that it would be harder to implement that than just having a KYC because there are so many more parameters that you need to take care of. Do you think that we'll ever get to a place in the world where KYC is not mandatory, or at least to a place where most things are done through ZK, so QIC would have a entirely different new flavor, or do you think that's not really realistic?
So my view here is as follows, right? Okay, this goes back to our previous conversation about SSL and all those things, right? If you were in the 90s and you came up to me and said, there's going to be a thing called the internet and everything is going to be bought on the internet, you might laugh me to the door, right? Fair? And I told you what are the key pieces that actually allowed us to do that, right? So, given I'm one of the people who actually believes in hardware, and hardware can actually do hardware acceleration, and I have like hardware in this room, which I've been tinkering with to accelerate. So for me, I rather believe, and I'm biased, that this can happen. And who knows, you could have a world where ZK is like, like coffee, like other things, like Google, the term Google. Like in the 90s, if you said term Google, what the hell is Google, right? So, same applies.
No, totally valid. And something else that I'm really curious about is the tokenomics behind Panther. How does the model look like? How did you arrive at this model? And in general, just what needs to be taken into account when token engineering and all that jazz?
Okay, so I'll make some broad statements, give some principles, and give you some examples. So I have been involved in the construct of token engineering from really the start. So I work with Trent, helping him with Ocean Protocol. So I've been doing token protocol engineering and token engineering before it had a name, right? So I did my early protocols very, very long before ERC20 was a thing with pre-minted tokens. Let's put it that way, right? For the people who understand what that means, that's what it means, right? So, I understood a lot of the things in cryptography. I understood a reasonable amount of things, what you call game theory, right? So, cryptography, as I described, I went to grad school. So, for me, it was like thing that I understood intuitively. Game theory, I understood it, but not to the mechanism design wasn't understood by me the degree that I know now. But it is a thing that you need to recognize and develop over time. So my views on token engineering, you can see like a token engineering group actually has a couple of my talks, and you can look at the Token Engineering Summit. I think the cynic's view of token engineering will give you like the construct in which how I think about protocol engineering and token engineering. I consider protocols like the same way as one would actually have like kids being trained to go to the real world, training them with as hard as problems. So you don't need to do helicopter monitoring in that sense, like helicopter parenting. So the protocol design in Panda is more or less that. Again, look, there is a trade-off, right? So when we were building Panther, we at least have two people involved in process. So me and my co-founder was very much of the investor type. I am very much of a builder type, right? What I mean by that is, like, I care about the protocol. My co-founder, you know, as an investor, you know, he represents the interest of investors. So it's a balance. So, you know, if it were up to me, I would have had a different set of choices, which is like very much a build-up, you know. So that probably, you know, it might not be the best thing to do. Again, just to be very fair, right? You know, everybody says that thing is like, you know, the best. But, you know, it's a very pragmatic trade-off. So you would see things which you would see very builder focus, and sometimes you see very investor focus. So the overall thing that we did was we actually made a very long schedule. So it's like our emission curve is for like 12 years. So 144 months, if I'm not mistaken. So this actually gives us time for the protocol to still self-stabilize. So, you know, the emission gets you running. And, you know, as a protocol, you have so much time to get to a steady state, right? So once the protocol gets a steady state, the steady state implies that the protocol can self-sustain. That's the first thing. Second thing is, the largest fraction of value is actually given for privacy staking, right? So you go in and, you know, room by the room thing, where if I'm in the room and I need to have more people in the room, incentivizing people to actually be in the room. That's, you know, the privacy staking. And, like, you know, overall, the design was made in such a way that, you know, long-term, a protocol has to succeed. Long-term, we should be able to support constructive decentralization. Long-term, we should allow other protocols to build and deploy things on top of Panther. This is the kind of thinking we had. So our tokenomics reflects that thinking.
It's easy to give an example that exists and kind of see how it applies, but what characteristics, what would be a good characteristics of good token engineering, or someone that's trying to come up with a model from scratch? What are the things that they should be looking at, and how they can apply to specific use cases?
So, you know, that's like a really hard question to answer, and I'll be very honest, I don't know an answer because I don't have a crystal ball, right? So, you know, I have to be very, very honest. So it's like, going back to my talk that I was describing 2018, I think I gave like a number of one less than X less than two or something like that. Very tiny fraction of the protocols at that point in time, I said, are going to survive, and which is exactly what it's going to be. Number one, which I think, which like, you have to think in terms of first principles, right? What does it mean? You need to have a protocol that actually has a natural use case. What I mean to that is like, A, this is not token gating in any sense, right? That's, token has a natural flow in the use case. Number two, this token actually unlocks real value, right? So in case of Panther, you know, if you have a strategy, you're making money, okay? That's unlocking value, right? When you make money, you know, this is what I normally describe. Like, the example I normally give is like, you don't go to McDonald's to buy a smoothie. You're unlikely to go to McDonald's to buy a smoothie. But when you buy a burger, you get a smoothie, right? So that's how this works. So when your protocol is there, the protocol piece has to be in the right order, right? The attraction is a burger, not the smoothie, right? So, you know, and you need to not have what do I call a user interaction, which really drives the user crazy. User shouldn't really care about the existence of the token. Ideally, you shouldn't even know the token exists, right? There should be a fair value capture that's there. So like the value capture that Uniswap has, like 30 bps, so something that people are willing to give up, right? And then, you know, if you actually have the ability to support interoperability and in a composability, then it actually helps you a lot more. So this would be my kind of take. And like, you know, you shouldn't actually go to niche spaces if you can avoid. Larger the size of the market, the better your chances are. Like, you know, you could think of doing a barter, right? Imagine you had some cows and I had some goats, right? You know, the coincidence of wants is much low probability event if you're just the two of us. Imagine there's 100,000 people. There's definitely somebody that'll be there. So you need to have a larger set. So you need to go to a market with a larger set. So you need to go to an L1 where it's large. And then, there are characteristics of an L1 and an L2 that enable certain things. So if you are trying to do, storage of data, you have a few pieces. One, the storage should be cheap. Computation should be cheap. Computation should be fast. The cost of doing all of this should be lower than the cost of actually doing storage, right? So these are first principles, things that you should actually check and things that actually should make sense to you. That is something that you should keep at the back of your mind. And if you don't keep it at the back of your mind, you might have challenges.
Yeah, that makes sense. And circling back to the advantages and values that users get from Panther, realizing that ability of arbitrage, right?
Yeah,
So
absolutely.
how exactly does what exactly are users using Panther for? What are they like? What drives them to use dark
We don't.
pools?
Yeah, so okay. The two questions are different. I need to full put disclaimers on. We're still in testnet. We are nowhere near mainnet. So I can't say what people are using for. My crystal ball is broken. I don't know in future. But I can tell you for a fact what dark pools are used for. Dark pools are used for all the transactions where you want to buy and sell without moving. Like think of OTC online, right? Over-the-counter transactions, right? So it doesn't really move the whole thing. So effectively, if you were to see in a public market somebody has put in a sell order, immediately you can say, everybody, oh shit, it's going to hit the fan. Price is going to go down. So whereas if you do a dark pool, it's not visible, so the price doesn't get affected. So there you go. That's a simpler way to describe it.
Yeah, that I think is an easy way to go to describe it. And when is it launching on mainnet? When should we expect to be able to use Panther?
My expectation is again, what I would say is there's an optimistic expectation and a pessimistic one, right? So, optimistic expectation is like in a 2 months' time, give or take. I think I kind of hand waved. We have like a 7-8 phased test deployment. We are parallelizing 4 and 6, which is kind of done last week. Not last week, last week on Monday. So we are in a place where we pretty much are doing good, right? So May, June, maybe, right? We should actually have things in the mainnet. So we have an order started, if I'm not mistaken, it's Monday. So things are happening. So things go according to plan. Again, there's an optimistic way and there's a pessimistic way. Pessimistic way is like, I don't know what it guys have to say to me. Optimistic way is like, yeah, everything is going to be fine. So I'm taking the optimistic thing and I'm saying, yeah.
And you mentioned interoperability.
Interoperability.
Yes, that. How is that a feature of Panther? What kind of people could build on top of Panther?
Could you repeat once more? So, yeah, there's a slight delay.
Yeah, so what type of interop
Interoperable.
how yeah, what kind of projects could interact with Panther, or what could be built either on top of in
Oh,
conjunction with
okay.
Panther?
Let's go back to our previous conversation. This is like a series of conversations, building back on the previous things we said. Remember, I was telling you about like Uniswap, Aave, and Curve, right? Tomorrow, you decide you want to have a special strategy which works across all these things to find a multi-legged strategy. You could even go across other EVM-compatible ones, and you can just deploy Panther across that. And then, effectively, you could build anything on top. All the strategies sat on top of it, right? World is your oyster. You go do whatever you want.
Sounds good. Awesome. Well, this has been a
Again, zero
very
knowledge.
interesting chat.
I was about to say, it was like, I'm not saying, trust me, bro. I'm saying, trust in zero knowledge.
Yes. Awesome. Yeah, I think that's a pretty good understanding of Panther and what it's used for, who should look out for it, and just in general, a good overview of crypto, like actual crypto, not the buzzword crypto, but actually cryptography.
Cryptography. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, thanks for the chat. It's been really cool. I feel like I learned a bunch and gave me
I guess
more
I convinced you to
questions that
read
I
books
began
now.
with. Yeah, I'm gonna have to buy some books. I'm gonna be traveling with a lot of books in my suitcase now. It's gonna be a
Yes, that's what I
nightmare.
do. Yeah.
Yeah.
As I said, like, look, everything has pros and cons. Life is all about choices. So there's a blue pill and a red pill. If I could convince you to take the red pill, you'll have a different view of the world. Thank you very much. It is a pleasure talking to you.